You're listening to Practically Ideal.
You gotta be practically ideal instead of just ideal.
Ready for some podcasting.
Oh, Logan, you got any better, man? All work and no play.
All right, we are live. This is Practically Culture, a podcast devoted to TV, movies, and other pop culture. I'm your host, Logan Bow, podcasting from Brooklyn. I'm joined by the one, the only Bob Caswell in the Bay Area. How are you, Bob?
I'm doing great. How are you? This is fun.
Good. Excellent. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to the new and improved podcast. We've got Mad Men, Arrested Development, Behind the Candelabra, Bob's list of must-see movies, my list of must-see TV on track. It's going to be a great episode. It's TV, it's movies, it's practically culture. Let's rock.
Sweet.
Oh, Bob. Great to be with you again. So many changes we should discuss.
I know. Yeah, you where to start. I'll let you discuss them.
First of all, it's nice to see those pretty blue eyes staring back at me via our live Google Hangout on air.
That's right. We're using all the fancy technology to make this shit real.
Yeah. And we're going to try to keep this Friday morning recording time relatively consistent so any of our listeners can join us live.
That's right.
While we record.
Yep.
And we're also going to chop this video into clips that you can watch in our new YouTube channel, just topic by topic. So if you want to get right to the Mad Men, boom, there you go.
Yeah.
Also, you may have noticed a name change. Careful listeners, I don't even have to be that careful of a listener. But instead of Practically Ideal, I introed Practically Culture at the beginning. Want to tell people what's with the name change, Bob?
Well, I think it speaks more to what we're really about. When we started Practically Ideal, we thought it would be, you know, a mix of politics, culture. We had like really high ambitions, and then we sort of filtered out politics over time, and we realized that we're just not as good or as interested in that. I don't know in what order, if that's the way to put it, but
no, right, right. I mean, we have a lot we'd love to talk about, but in order to help our listeners find the stuff that's most important to them, to you, our listeners, we wanted to get more focused with our weekly podcast and emphasize the pop culture. We think we're really at our best when we do that anyway. Practically Ideal won't necessarily be going away, but we'll publish there less frequently, saving it for some of the bigger ideas and conversations we have, and keeping the TV and movies aspect lean and mean.
Yeah, yeah, and it's the easy thing to talk about week to week. There's lots of fun happening. It's good times. Feels like Practically Ideal was going to take a lot more effort to put in discussions on those longer-term topics, if you will.
Yeah, so it just makes sense.
Yep.
Third, we've got a new website to reflect our
That's
new
right.
structure. For the pop culture content, visit us at practicallyculture.com. Some parts are still under construction, just to warn you, but what you find there is a site dedicated to all the pop culture that you love and that you know we love. Finally,
cool.
One more. Along with that, we're playing with some format changes, new segments and all that. Stick with us today and let us know what you think. Drop us a line at the new website, practicallyculture.com, or on the old Facebook page, which will soon be renamed Practically Culture instead of Practically Ideal, though it has not been renamed yet. And of course, on Twitter, at Logan Bow or at Bob Caswell.
Wow.
That cover it, Bob?
I think so. Are we ready to do this? It's just so weird. I can't like pick my nose and not have people notice.
Picking my nose was a one of the things I saved for the podcast recording, so that's going to be a real change.
Yep, me too.
All right. Well, Bob, let's get to, let's talk Mad Men. And I know you never say ha and you never say boo.
Wait, what?
Don't you remember?
Father
Abraham.
Seven sons. Yeah, that was pretty random. Okay.
Okay. So it's my little reference there. Maybe that didn't work so well. First of all, what about Betty, huh? A stunning comeback performance.
She is back and looking better than ever and doing her thing and taking on Don as a lead almost. It's great. I love it. You?
Yeah. Yeah, she's blonde, skinny, confident, getting tons of attention from other men. And we know this because the first time we see her, Betty's getting hit on while Henry's on the phone. I don't know about you, but I feel like Betty's been kind of a drag on the series the last couple of years, probably.
Yeah.
But this time she was back.
they got divorced, and then they had the parallel stories going, and it felt very like forced, or like, well, we have to keep her in the show, and here she is. And not forced, but just a drag. I think you said it well.
Yeah, yeah. So that first thing, it's sort of a, well, I don't know. Do you think this is a usual thing? So we had Betty getting hit on by that other dude, and then we had Henry finding out, and then in the car, he's like, turn up the privacy divider, and he grills her. Like, what did he say? What else did he say? Is that everything? And then all of a sudden, we find out this is like some elaborate foreplay, that it really gets him going.
I guess. Is that what the takeaway was supposed to be? Or was it just in the moment, he's like, all right, we're done with that. Now, lay it on me, sugar.
Well, it seemed like he was mad, but at the same time, he was getting turned on. So it makes me wonder if this is like a game they play, like every Friday night. Like, try to get hit on, Betty. Then I'm going to make you tell me what he says, and then you're going to be mine.
Right. And you juxtapose that with the lack of games with, you know, how Dawn and her came onto each other. And it's just like, are we doing this? Okay.
Yeah, I guess you're sort of right. I mean, Dawn will get kinky sometimes, as we've definitely seen.
Yeah.
Certainly playing those power, dominant, submission games. But less this time.
Right, and I don't know what to think of that, because on the one hand, it was fun to see them get back together. On the other hand, it felt very like, what's the point of this? They sort of almost hinted at Dawn wanting to come back to Betty, but then Betty quickly was like, no, I'm happy. I'm just doing this because, you know, whatever.
Yeah, well, that was one of the things, right? Betty is so confident, so sure of herself, so at ease, at peace with the choices she's made. She's like, yeah, I'll sleep with Dawn, but I'm not going to go back to Dawn.
Right.
And then the next morning, you know, we see that she's very friendly and flirty and affectionate with Henry still. Doesn't want to go back to Dawn at all. And Dawn, like, goes over and sits at that little tiny table alone. Like, oh, okay.
Yeah, he's got no one with him. Oh, that's sad. Great. Except for not really sad, because it's Dawn. But yeah, I think it's a good thing for Betty. I don't know what else to say about it other than she looks great. She's back. She has more confidence. I don't know where it's going to go. It's like the end of the season. We saw her fat, then brown hair, and now it's like skinny and blonde again. And I don't know if that's supposed to play a trick on me. Like, am I supposed to not assume she's in a better place? But it sure seems like she is, so I don't know.
Yeah, she added a lot to the episode. It seems like she's the only one who understands Dawn too.
Right.
Like, I love how you look at me, but I know that it never lasts. And poor Megan, she doesn't realize that loving you is the worst way to get to you.
Yeah.
Whew. So what do you think, Bob? Who's the margarine and who's the butter between Henry and Dawn in Betty's life?
I know. I think Dawn is the margarine and Henry is the butter, as it were.
Oh, wow. So Henry tastes better, but Dawn's cheaper?
Yeah. I guess I could see it either way, but I feel like she's moved on. Dawn isn't a need for her anymore. She's almost toying with him more than she's, you know, getting upsold when she goes back to Dawn. I don't know.
Yeah, it seems like her personal validation. She's derived value from her ability to be attractive to other men, and then she went through a phase of not feeling attractive. And so if she can get Dawn back, I guess that sort of seals the deal. Yep, I got it. Thanks, Dawn. Later.
Right. Is it just me, or does Betty almost make Megan look worse? Now, this is going to sound very, I'm politically incorrect or whatever, but it's easy to just compare the way women look when a show is about a dude who's sleeping with both of them. I don't know how else to put it. And Megan just like looks less attractive right now because of Betty looking so much more attractive. I don't know if that was on purpose, but if you notice in the episode, Megan's hair wasn't ever done up and she wasn't wearing anything as nice and she wasn't like dolled up in the way she normally is for Dawn. And I'm not saying that that's how it should be or shouldn't be, but it just makes for some contrast that I feel like was on purpose.
Yeah, well, let me see if I can put us back on the feminist rails here, Bob, but agree with you.
Okay.
I feel like you're right. Betty was more attractive than Megan this episode, but I feel like it wasn't only because of those conventional things, because Betty was sure of herself, confident, knew what she wanted. She was taking charge of her own experience, whereas Megan wasn't so much, and so Betty taking the power was part of what made her more attractive than Megan in this episode.
Okay, sure. But even if the thing was on mute, my point still holds true. I don't mean to be non-feminist by it, but One look.
Okay, trying to save you there, Bob, but you can...
I'll just drown myself. Yeah, what was that? No, yes, I agree with you, Logan. That was all very calculated and because of inner emotional feelings less so than outward looks. Okay.
No, you're right, though. I think both were definitely there. So butter and margarine, it's hitting us over the head with that. So I sort of went with it, said, okay, well, let's think about this show, this episode in terms of butter and margarine. Don and Ted, you know, they're arguing in the beginning about how to pitch their margarine client, taste or taste and price. And, you know, we already talked, cheaper substitutes was a big theme of this episode. And I started thinking about this from Peggy's point of view, all the men in Peggy's life. Don was like the original butter for her, but then she chose to go away from Don and right. has all these other men. It's working out in various ways.
Right. Yeah, and I thought it was interesting too that margarine by definition is already an imitation, and so to compete, it's almost Peggy has all these other options that aren't Don, and compared to each other, what's the point in differentiating when they're just not Don is the most obvious thing. But like, she was never in the running for Don anyway, so I don't know where to take this, but interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, well, maybe not in the running for Don sexually or romantically, but in the beginning, certainly she looked at Don very much as a mentor, but in later episodes, and now that she's back again, it seems like Don, you know, Don is not always very nice to her, just because Don can be mean to people. And even in the terms of mentor, the way it went with Ted, I don't know. It seems like she thought she was choosing butter, but maybe they're both margarine. Because Ted, obviously, just to get that on the table, Ted comes and says, "Well, you can't touch my hand. Is this hard for you or is it only hard for me? Oh, I wish we could be together, blah, blah, blah." Peggy goes through her other story, stabs her current boyfriend, who, just to get through that quickly, I guess, I thought it was hilarious when they're on the table and he's like, "This is not because of what you did, but your every waking moment is offensive to me." So we've got an end here. Anyway, she goes back to Ted, "Hey, I'm available." And he's like, "Oh, great. Well, it's Monday morning. Let's get back to work."
I'm happy for Peggy to be, you know, to have a breakup with her. I think it's time for her to move on. And he was just always kind of the epitome of what everyone is annoyed about toward liberals.
Yeah, he was the 29-cent margarine.
That's right.
But what do you think? Well, I mean, we've spent a lot of time in this season thinking about how Don and Ted are different, especially from Peggy's point of view. But I think this episode, you know, Don early. So let's see. Let me get this straight. So. After Peggy doesn't take a side, Don comes in and says, "Hey, there's right or wrong." And she's like, "Well, I think you're both pretty similar, except he never makes me feel this way." Don says nastily, "Oh, well, he doesn't know you like I do." Then fast forward to the end, all of a sudden, Ted is making Peggy feel terrible.
Yep. Yep. And Don is kind of a dick in that moment when he's like, he doesn't know you like I do, but he just says it how it is. It's kind of true because Don has been with her through a lot of shit that nobody else knows about.
Absolutely.
And Ted is just a surface level fling. And so Peggy fell for that old formula of like, "This guy makes me feel special." It's like, that's just because you've only been on two dates with him and not even really any in this case.
Yeah. We didn't talk specifically about last week's episode, Bob, but very briefly, what did you think of that crazy episode?
Oh, remind me, what was the craziness again?
Oh, the energy shots that made everyone go.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Loopy. Yeah. That was kind of a bizarre episode. Everyone was kind of flying high and Don was on top of his game, but off his rocker at the same time.
Yeah, it was obviously an experimental episode. I don't remember the LSD episode from a year or two back. Uh-huh. That one was actually kind of interesting, the way they played with LSD. I don't know. This one didn't work quite as well for me. The last one didn't work as well for me.
It was kind of a trip, but you had to remind me of it. It didn't leave a lasting impression. Let's just put it that way.
So the reason I bring that up is that with this episode, this week's episode, I feel like we had another great one. You know, in addition to Betty's huge comeback, which is obviously marking... are going well for the episode. Well, see, I think Mad Men is at its very best, honestly, when it makes me feel like shit. And I mean, in the past, there have been episodes that have quite literally triggered like an entire week or more of actual depression in me.
Wow.
If I'm watching at a rough time in my life and we get a story arc about Sal or Pete or Don or Peggy or Lane or Joan or basically it could be anyone, if it hits close to home, it can push me right over the edge into a serious funk.
Okay, so here's the thing, not to derail, but just briefly, I'm watching Breaking Bad right now, and I swear everything you just described applies to me channeling Breaking Bad. There are certain episodes where I'm like, holy, how does it know that that this is getting in my head, and it's great, but it's also just depressing. For everyone, just so you know quickly, I'm catching up on Breaking Bad because of the sixth season starting, I think, in August, and I'm behind, but I'm only in season two right now, but everything Logan just described is happening to me for Breaking Bad, so
there you go. Wow. This is something we've got to explore in these supposedly great TV shows.
Right.
But anyway, for some reason, it's bad for my life, but I love it when Mad Men makes me feel something that strongly. And this one started to get to that a little bit when I just felt so bad for Peggy at the end. And also, you know what? Roger. I felt really bad for Roger, too. He's made his choices. He has to live with the consequences. But yeah, he's trying to be grandpa. No one wants him to be. He's trying to be dad. No one wants him to be.
Roger's so aloof, though. Like, Peggy, you feel bad because she's consciously aware of her environment and her crappy situation. Roger, it's hard to feel bad for him because he's like, oh, I'll just sleep in and throw money at something else, go see a movie in the afternoon, drink until I can't remember things.
But don't you think he felt pretty bad about it this time?
I didn't really get it for like 2 seconds, and then he probably forgot about it and was on to his next like whimsical thing.
All right. Well, maybe so. Maybe so. What else do we talk about? Joan and Bob Benson? Is that a thing? Is that confirmed?
I was confused by that. They went to the beach together, because you could tell by his crazy shorts. 70s shorts.
But it sort of suggested maybe they're a thing, but I feel like it did leave some leeway for them just to have been an innocent little beach trip.
Yeah. Oh, but Joan did say something about Pete to Bob, and I thought that was really interesting. Here, let me see if I can find it so I can say it the right way. He's the only one who hasn't broken a promise to me. And I'm like, really? We're talking about Pete? And then I'm recounting.
Yeah, that's exactly what you... let me think.
Oh, somebody said something flattering about the guy that everyone loves to hate. And it was Joan, of all people. I don't know. It's interesting.
Flattering seems to maybe be putting it a little bit strongly.
maybe so.
Because it kind of means he's always been upfront about being a dick.
Oh, I didn't take it that way. I took it as like she has concern for him because he's the last bastion of traditional, honest, upfront relationshipness or something. And I don't know.
Yeah, there's probably some of that too. Because I think she was saying it in the context of, I care for him a little bit. It'd be nice to make his life a little bit better. And then, of course, Bob Benson. Who is this dude, Bob Benson? He goes and I feel like that's exactly what Pete would do at the end. Like, I want to be very delicate about this, but here's a nurse, comes with the highest recommendations. And don't be mad at Joan. It's just that she's concerned about you and knows that I share that concern for you. And she'd exhausted her resources. That seems like something Pete would say. But here's Bob Benson doing it. And just who is this guy? Is he nice or is he playing the long game here?
Yeah, I think he's playing the long game, but I don't know. I'm still distracted because he's a character that I liked from the short-lived show Political Animals. But I like him as an actor and as a character, though, I'm still torn and I'm still thinking more about him as an actor, I guess. I don't know.
Well, very mysterious. I don't think we know what to think about him yet.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else? Megan being come on to by her swinger co-star. Is there any chance that does not end up badly for Megan?
She said it straight to her face. I mean, Megan said it straight to her co-star's face. Like, you're my boss, and I want to say no, but how do you think this is going to play out? And then her co-star was like, or you're the wife of my boss, is what she said. Yeah. Her co-star's like, well, you know, you can just say no. You don't have to, like, rub it in my face. But I guess if I were Megan, I probably would have handled it the same way. Like, this is really weird, and in real time, I'm just expressing things. Not going to be good.
Yeah, is it going to be over for Megan in her acting career?
I think so, but it could surprise us.
Yeah, things end badly, not well, which is one of the reasons I like Mad Men, actually, as I was just describing.
I tepidly agree.
All right. That about does us. Anything else you want to say about this episode, Bob?
That's it. I'm looking forward to the season finale. Is that the next one, or do we have one more before? I think we're at the end.
Are we at the very end? Oh, wow. I thought we maybe had two more. I guess I should be aware of that, but it's coming right up.
Right up, yep.
All right. Let's talk about the other big TV event this week, Bob. Arrested Development dropped. How many episodes have you seen?
I've seen 4, and I've made Facebook comments after seeing 3.
I'm up to 9, and okay. I'm honestly kind of slogging through them. Where does they end up coming together somewhat by the end, but still not necessarily in the best way possible, but in a good way, I guess. I'm just trying to read some reviews and make my way through them. And I'm sure we'll talk about Arrested Development at least once more, maybe multiple times more. But for now, let's just give our first impressions. So, before I get your impressions of these, you've sort of hinted, but let me ask. Were you a fan of Arrested Development the first 3 seasons?
I was. I was late to the party, so I did watch them like as a... This is even before streaming, but it was kind of a DVD binge. Went through all 3 seasons really fast. Especially the first 2 were fantastic. The third one sort of... It wasn't a letdown, but it just wasn't quite at the same level as the first 2, and now here we are with the 4th, and spoiler alert... It's lower than the third by quite a bit.
Lower than the third by quite a bit. Okay, well, let's talk about your impressions after the first, 4 episodes, did you say?
Yeah, 4 episodes. Now, it's funny because I commented on Facebook, I've only seen 3, but is this like a Star Wars sort of deal where it's coveted and then it comes back and it's like the same people, but you're kind of torn because you want to like it, but it's just really not as good? That's how I feel. Maybe not as extreme, but... I don't know.
Yeah, well, I have a theory that's actually not too far from yours. And that theory is that because of the circumstances of Arrested Development's original run, we tend to remember it as better than it was, maybe. I mean, don't get me wrong. At times, it could be a truly great show. The way it developed a joke, its hyper-conscious cleverness, the comedic risk-taking, its recurring punchlines. But there were some things about the original greatness that can't easily be recreated. For one, I mean, they got just the obstacles. It was hard to get the cast all the way together. And so that just made some things not work. And also, the length is a little bit too long. I think they vary from 28 to 37 minutes. And I think they would have benefited most of them from being shrunk down to a normal 20 plus minutes. But here's a controversial part, Bob.
Okay, let's hear it. Controversy.
You said that you came late to Arrested Development.
Yep.
I came slightly late myself. It was sort of a fringe show when it aired, but I think that made it better to the people who did love it in real time. An underappreciated show always gets bonus love, if you know what I mean. So the TV hipsters who were watching before it was cool were like this little club. Do you remember the very first pop culture blog we ever wrote for in like 2004, 2005? Kultur Blog?
Yes, I do remember that.
Well, I remember the few people who were watching the show when it aired would always throw around these lines that made no sense at all to me. It'd be like, "No touching," or "Steve Holt." but it made him just crack up talking about it. It was like this little club this little cult of Arrested Development. But now it's pretty popular, and it's actually overhyped, if anything, I would say.
Yeah, your theory is way more... nuanced and thought through. Mine was a lot more straightforward, and it was just one of your points, but I think it's the largest point. And I think it's the way that they're filming this with the whole one character at a time approach. I just don't think it's working. The formula was always the whole family and Michael, the main character's interactions with all of them almost every episode, and they're all sitting around half the time, and it's funny to see rich people dealing with their rich people problems. And now it's like each episode is like, hey, it's Michael's Arrested Development, it's Lindsay's Arrested Development, and the whole episode revolves around one character who was never funny or meant to be funny in isolation. And I think that's the true breakdown, is they're half-assing this whole production. They're like, oh, if we get everyone together just enough so that we can make some token, you know, scenes where other people show up in the episode, but it's all new people and just one character, man, it just shows how important the full ensemble cast really is. That's my theory anyway.
That makes a lot of sense. Because I think you're right, it's very ensemble based originally. The way they're doing it now, it's like everyone's the star of their own little mini episode, or one episode, but only mini series.
Yeah.
And you talk about half-assing it. I've heard that The idea for Mitch Hurwitz was always to make the movie. He really wants to make the movie, and then this episode was just to sort of tell the backstory so everyone's caught up for the movie he wants to make. So I've heard some speculation that he actually was half-assing this, saving his better ideas for a potential movie that may or may not ever come.
Yeah, okay, so that makes sense. Then that my theory holds true, even with that second piece of information. I like that, or knowing that anyway, because it validates the whole thing, the whole problem for me. I'm just not really enjoying it. So I thought the first episode was okay. So these aren't spoilers. I'm just going to say quickly, because it's just four episodes. First episode was Michael and his son, and those were really the only two characters. The second episode was George Sr., you know, Jeffrey... What's that actor's name?
Jeffrey Tambor. Let me just cut in. Way too much George Sr. so far.
Oh, yeah, so far. And the second episode was totally about him, and it was overkill. That one I fell asleep during. And the third episode was all about Lindsay, and I was just distracted by her new face, which is kind of all the buzz on the internet. So I don't know what's going on there, if that's a subtle...
Everyone's like 7 years older, you know?
Yeah, but she looks it. Or, you know, there's some theories that people are like, well, it could be that the creators, they always thought her character would play around with plastic surgery, and maybe they're just subtly messing with her in post-production, and then they're going to do a reveal that she got plastic surgery later. And I'm like, that's an elaborate story to cover up. Somebody just doesn't look as attractive 7 years later. So, sorry to say, I don't know. Right. She looks way different by comparison. Everyone else, about the same. Anyway,
yeah, the third, surprisingly the same for a lot of the people, except Michael Cera, who's this lanky college kid now, but right, that's to be expected.
What else did I want to say? The third and fourth episode, I can't even remember what I wanted to say. It's that interesting. Let me just say that after watching three, I was kind of disappointed, and then I had multiple people on Facebook come to me and say, oh, stick with it. It gets better after the first three, and I'm like, there is no way that this is just randomly that I'm commenting after the three where it's bad and it right before it picks up. It just felt like a little, you know, people are just defending it for defending, you know, sake. Because then I watched the fourth one, and in their defense, it was slightly better than the third one. But I don't think the whole series is going to pick up as a result of this.
Yeah, the best I've heard, you know, again, trying to be unspoiled, is that it's impressive the way it ties together all the plot lines by the end. And like, oh wow, that was masterfully done. Some people say that. But most people seem to agree, most critics at least, that it's uneven in the way that at times it shows its old brilliance, but at times it just is terrible. And so one of those medium ratings where it's both good and bad instead of just medium good.
Right, and it's a benefit of the doubt good, because it's literally like 2 minutes out of 30 is good.
Yeah.
And yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Anything you do like about it?
You know, I do love the quirkiness of the characters. It's over-narrated, but I did like the narration, which is another problem. It feels like there's more narration than even before. But
Ron Howard is really the star of this. Have you gotten to any of the Ron Howard episodes? I can't remember when they start coming in.
Yeah, that's episode four when he comes in. I really like Isla Fisher, and she's the love interest for Michael, and she comes in episode four as well. She's fun. I feel cool. Like I'm reaching here, though.
Let me see what I wrote down. What about the cameos, like Kristen Wiig and Seth Rogen as the young Bluths?
They were funny at first, but now they're just stupid funny. I don't know what to say. They're not that clever.
The joke is that it's those two actors. It's the, you know, so you see them, oh, that's the joke, but we've already seen the joke that it's those two actors. Next.
Right. Yeah.
What else do I have here? I don't know if this is damning with faint praise, but I like that it feels a lot like the original show, just like the pacing, the narration feels the same, and even like the little music medley at the end of each episode, where it goes from like the Arrested Development to the Imagine to the Fox, like sounds exactly the same as before.
there's some nostalgia there. I guess that's fun, but by the way, this failed the wife-o-meter. I'm watching this by myself now after three episodes. It's just for the show, so I'm doing this for the peeps out there.
Wow, yeah. That's dedication. did she like the first three seasons?
Yeah. We watched them all together on that DVD binge fest a few years back. But this fourth one, after three episodes, and we both fell asleep kind of on the third one. I'm all alone here.
doing it for the art, for the craft. Wow,
that's okay. Right.
Well. Well, let me ask you this then, the one more thing that I feel is pretty interesting. So this is the second major Netflix release of original content, Bob, after House of Cards. What do you think of this all-at-once streaming distribution model now that we've got a second data point here?
I think it's weird because we've talked about how you're not on the same page with anyone. You're all watching it at your own pace. You can't talk about it week to week. The water cooler, proverbial water cooler chatter is all sorts of messed up. And you also kind of have a sense of procrastination. I mean, it's not like a real problem in life to be like, oh, I got to get around to watching the TV that everyone's watching. But you sort of get that feeling a little bit like you're behind even though you haven't started. I don't know that I like it, but I think it's here to stay. And I don't know. It's probably going to be fine.
You will learn to live with it. One of the things that was potentially interesting was that Mitch Hurwitz was trying to play around with this new format by making it so he could watch the episodes in any order. But it turned out that he's like, no, that would have been way too hard. So watch them in the right order, please. And that would have been an interesting way to take advantage of this new content delivery system.
He says that, but of the first four episodes, especially the first three, you could watch them in any order. It doesn't really matter. You don't care about anything or nothing ties together very well.
So it hasn't been interesting enough for me to take detailed notes, sort of like what you're saying. But I feel like the first three or four episodes, it says like the exact same story, but from each different person's point of view. Then I feel like at four or five, we start to get like the next phase of the story at least. So I feel like that aspect does go away after the first few. Starts to become clear that the right order is there.
And here's one disclaimer I feel like giving. I didn't rewatch the first three seasons in preparation for this fourth one, and maybe that would have helped, or that's the way to do it, because it's been like 5 years since I watched them, and that was even late to the party, and I still don't remember that much. So like they just jump right back in with all these plot lines of who's in jail and who's in what court case, and frankly, I could care less. Like, it's such low stakes. Like, you just don't care. You don't care about anything happening to any character. And, you know, Lindsay goes to India and I don't know. There's just stuff happens randomly. There's just no rhyme or reason. It's just kind of a random reason to get these familiar faces on the screen. That's part of why it's not working for me is I used to care about the progression of the story and the characters and the development, but now it just feels like a hodgepodge of throwbacks and uninteresting story.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, you have that problem a little bit when it's just like been, you know, 9 months since the last time you watched this series. Like, oh, what's going on again? Like we did that with Shannon, where we had to get all the way ready for Game of Thrones. But now it's been up to 7 years, potentially, since the last time you watched these people. They could do a little bit more to help bridge that gap.
Exactly.
All right. Are you leaning toward a rating yet?
You know, I'm oscillating between 2 and 3 stars, man. This is pretty harsh by Bob's standards.
Yeah,
it might get the token 3-star. You know, it didn't waste my time. If it picks up a little bit and people are actually accurate and it gets better after the first three episodes, but if it stays anywhere in this vicinity, it's going to be closer to a 2-star. Maybe I'll give it a 2.5 token, like. Right in the middle there. I don't know.
You need to exercise that 2.5 slot now that you've got it.
That's right.
I'm aiming toward about 3, somewhere in that range, but we'll see.
Yeah.
All right. Bob, I just barely finished watching Behind the Candelabra right before we started recording. So just barely. So I will admit I'm still gathering my thoughts. But my first question, Bob, whose category is this? It's a TV movie. Me on TV or you on movies?
Yeah, I was confused by that too. It's HBO, which is solid TV. I feel like it's right down the middle, man.
It's like a movie. Steven Soderbergh, A-list cast, you know. This could have been a movie in theaters.
And I think originally that was the intention, but nobody wanted to make it, so HBO came to the rescue. So it's kind of more movie-esque in that sense.
It is. In fact, hold that thought. After we talk a little bit more about it, I want us to come back and reevaluate that decision.
Okay.
I'll definitely bring that question up. Okay, so directed by Steven Soderbergh, written by Richard LaGravanese, starring Michael Douglas and Matt Damon, about Liberace and his chauffeur, boy toy lover, Scott Thorson. Focus on their relationship, its ups and downs. Like, we'll do this mostly spoiler free, I suppose, at this point. Critics seem to be quite favorable towards it, and it got a high rating for an HBO movie, so critics and audiences seem to be on board. Did you do a mini review for this one?
I did. I gave it 4 out of 5. Let me find it here. Let me read what I said.
Okay.
Fascinating portrayal of a complex yet simple man and his lover, with great performances by Michael Douglas, Matt Damon, and Rob Lowe.
It does, makes me laugh.
Yeah. It does well presenting the story without condoning or condemning any of the particulars.
Mm.
And I stick by that. I really thought Soderbergh did a great job of just like, here's this crazy true story. In contrast to that piece of shit movie I saw last week, Pain and Gain, which was also based on a true story, but it was Michael Bay's version of a crazy true story that's not interesting at all and shown on the screen. This story was crazy, and I guess part of my issue for not having this be a masterpiece or a better movie, like it didn't feel quite like a 5 out of 5 for me, was the trade-offs there. You kind of get this sense at the end, like you don't know what the point was. It's just a slice of life sort of movie. Fascinating to see someone have a relationship in an age when it wasn't acceptable, but then it wasn't acceptable on a whole other plane for a whole other host of reasons. And then in the end, you're like, eh. Interesting. Now what?
So, I agree with you. I actually think that's really more interesting, and that is the effect. Let me explain what I mean. So,
okay,
Liberace at the time, this archetype of flamboyant, super gay, even though he never admitted to being gay, just crazy, extravagant piano player.
Yeah.
And of course, having a gay relationship at the time, that was, you know, scandalous. It's something you definitely did not want to make public, and he didn't make it public. Today, that's almost like, you know, it's no big deal. It's whatever. I mean, this could have been. It's interesting how this movie in general is almost conventional and almost like also traditional. The way this relationship is made to look, Liberace's like this archetype, like I said, for the flamboyant gay character. But that stays under control. They don't play that up, even though they acknowledge it. And this story could have been any number of wealthy older men taking on a sweet young girl and then growing tired of her. Liberace just looks like a regular powerful man taking advantage of a young, naive lover in some ways. And I think it's kind of mind-blowing that this story could be made to be just that same old tale. And I think that's kind of interesting.
Wow, that is a good point. I think the difference, though, is that There was a couple of different scenes, and this isn't really a spoiler, but it is getting into a little bit of the nuance. There's a theme throughout the movie that Liberace wanted this lover of his who was like really could have been his grandson. But to your point, that sort of story happens all the time with older men and younger women,
yeah.
Donald Trump style, or you know, name anyone in it that's in that category. But in this case, Liberace wanted to be like a father figure, explicitly a lover, a family member, wanted to adopt him as a son. There was a lot of that in the storyline, which I don't think we've seen in the rich older man takes on a younger woman storyline. That is almost kind of implied, but then when it's so explicit in this movie as a thing that he's trying to accomplish or wanting to get out of life, it sort of makes it extra creepy on top of the gay factor, which then makes you like do a double take and you're like, no, but it's okay that it's the gay side of this because it's no different than the straight side. But then all the craziness on top of it warps everything together to make you feel like you're being manipulated to be judgmental in some extra way because of the combination with the gayness of it. Or I don't know, it's weird.
Yeah, I'll co-sign that one. So it brings up the gayness as something that you can take a step back and look at instead of just react the way you know, someone who's very uncomfortable with the idea of gayness at all would just be, oh, that's wrong, it can't be forgiven at all. it puts that out in front so we can take a step back and look, huh, should I give them more credit because they're gay? Maybe this is a bad thing to do anyway.
Yeah. I mean, just to clarify a little bit, I feel like, you know, I don't have any problem with gay relationships, nor should I, but it's not really. But this movie forces you to draw your own line of judgment. Like, you're not going to walk away saying that was totally normal and fine and that was an acceptable way to live a life. But you're also not going to walk away and say, because of this, gays are a problem in society. Unless you're really, you know, you could walk away that way and say that, I guess. But it just is weird that it makes you decide for yourself where the line is.
Yeah.
And I think it's different for everyone and nobody's going to want to talk about it, but that's what you're going to be thinking when you're done watching the movie.
Sure. Let's talk about the acting performances. What did you think of Michael Douglas as Liberace Lee?
I thought he did a great job. He brought in to the character a lot of charm. He spoke a little bit different. He wasn't as Michael Douglas-y as he normally is. I don't know Liberace that well as a personality. He was like my grandparent sort of dude, not something I was interested in. But I could tell Michael Douglas was doing a performance that was based on a real persona, and I thought that was pretty well done.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I don't know Liberace firsthand pretty much at all. I may have seen the occasional clip of him, like very occasional, and I just knew that he was an extravagant piano player. But I agree, Michael Douglas, it was obvious that he was doing a great job, even though we didn't know Liberace very well. I was completely mesmerized. I think it was the best part of this whole movie, to be quite honest. Michael Douglas is usually like this macho alpha male type of guy, and he plays Liberace with a certain flamboyance. It's never a caricature, though, and it's never too much, but it's just a completely different person than Michael Douglas usually plays, and it's pretty brilliant.
Yeah, and I don't know what to call it, but I want to say there's the subtle gay factor is spot on, because gays have been portrayed over the top forever, you know, in, mm-hmm. in media and Hollywood. I'm thinking of like Modern Family or...
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. There are plenty of gays who are probably in line with that kind of
personality. Well, Liberace would be a great candidate to be over the top with, if you
right,
if
you yeah, you could, yeah, exactly. But I think Michael Douglas took the harder road, but ultimately the more fulfilling one of you can't quite tell, other than you already know what the story is and you know that he's gay because the movie sort of gives it to you up front, but you can't quite tell that he's gay 100% because he's and I think that speaks to how it really is in real life. There's kind of a spectrum of well, we don't have to go here, but I guess not everyone is a flamboyant gay or an alpha male, right? There's a lot of nuance in between.
Yeah. And he wasn't a caricature, and it would have been super easy to be a caricature, and just great performance.
Yeah, really good.
What about Matt Damon?
Oh, I thought Matt Damon did a fantastic job as well. I'm a huge Matt Damon fan anyway, so maybe I'm a little biased, but he maybe more understated performance, because he was just a quiet young guy who only had a couple of explosion scenes as the story went on, but was kind of in the background for a lot of it at the beginning. But he did what he needed to do and didn't overplay it or underdo it. I think it was just right.
Yeah, I thought it was good too. I'm still processing it, to be quite honest. But I feel like Matt Damon's Scott Thorson is almost like a classic damsel in distress. You know, he's not really an agent of his own destiny. Things happen to him. Again, that's something we don't usually see from Matt Damon. But the more I think about it, the more I'm pretty impressed with that one, too.
Yeah. And we have to mention Rob Lowe, because... Now, if you want to talk about over the top and really playing it up... But, you know, this. There are people like this, I suppose.
It was like this plastic surgeon... And also a California diet drug dealer. and that's something they did to his face, made it look like he had about 10 million facelifts himself.
I know. We should talk about that briefly. Like, the whole movie had some really impressive special effects if you consider how hard it is to show
the
people...
The makeup design stuff?
Yeah, yeah, before and after plastic surgery. Like Matt Damon with raised cheekbones and a dimple in his chin. And it was just really... funky but still felt accurate, because we've seen what plastic surgery can make people look like, good or bad, and the movie sort of accurately portrayed that, I think.
It was pretty good the way they with Liberace pre and post facelift too. That was impressive.
Yeah, it was interesting.
I don't know exactly how to talk about Rob Lowe, but he's sort of creepy but cool. Well, I liked watching him. I don't know if I would want to hang out with him, but he did a good job. Just steals every scene he's in, practically.
He does steal the scene, because he's just got way too much plastic surgery, and he's got this larger-than-life personality of like, oh, yeah, nobody's written anything bad about these pills. They're fine. Take some more, you know, and it's just this really fascinating character. I thought he did a great job.
Yeah, definite addition. So what's your rating, Bob?
4 out of 5. I thought it was solid. Really enjoyed the performances. Thought it was an interesting story. I guess it's, and I liked how the director stepped back and just let it unfold in its own way. But somehow, it's not as brilliant in the end as I would have liked to have seen it be. But I mean, that's a harsh way to put it. But it just left me wondering a little bit more, wanting more. Closure or some stronger point to the thing other than just showing a story for what it is. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a movie that I liked a lot but didn't necessarily love and feel amazing about. But and I'm still thinking about it. Like I say, I just barely finished watching it. But I'm thinking around a 4 or 4.5 out of 5 stars probably for me. So right in that same range.
Nice. Cool.
One of our favorite things about this show is having fun conversations about the pop culture we love. As a way to structure our viewing to help make sure we see the same stuff, and also to help our listeners follow along with what we see, we're going to share our top secret personal lists of the TV and movies we will be watching. We're culture junkies, of course, so we'll be watching a lot more than what's on our lists, but these cover the bare minimum, in our opinion, that everyone should be watching, and they'll also provide a roadmap for what we'll cover in depth on the show. So we got some lists for you. You can find them on our website at practicallyculture.com, too. But, Bob, we did this a couple months back. It's time for a new installment. I want to hear your must-see movies. Give us the top 5 must-see movies in the next 3 months for you, Bob, and I promise I'll watch all of them so we can talk about them. Lay them on us.
Wow. Okay. I actually only have 4 at this point.
Okay. In progress. I'll take it. Yeah. I'll allow it.
But here are the 4 movies, and 3 of them are in June, actually. Maybe some of these other ones come closer, they'll become more must-see for me. But I'm just going to say them briefly and then go into some of the detail. The Internship is coming up next week, actually. It's a Vince Vaughn, Owen Wilson comedy. I think this is...
All right.
Listen. I think this is a must-see because this duo has had their on and offs on the screen in terms of huge success and then sort of total failure, but when they hit, and it's getting a lot of positive buzz, especially in the kind of the techie circles that I follow,
because they're at Google, right? Sorry if I'm jumping again, but
sorry, circles, the premise here is two guys who are older and get laid off and then have to kind of figure out how to change their career when they're in their late 30s, early 40s, and they decide to sign up for an internship at Google. And so the whole thing is filmed, or not the whole thing, but part of it, and it's meant to look like it's all on Google's campus. It's just the comedy of middle-aged dudes interacting with fresh MBAs or engineering grads straight out of college. And it looks funny, but it's one of those things where the preview could show all the funny parts, but the fact that my techie circle friends are saying it's actually a lot of fun, and it pays homage to a lot of techie cultural sort of things that make it, for me, really relevant. And I think the A-list cast and putting Google front and center, it's not to be missed. I'm hoping it's as good as my tech friends think it is.
All right,
we'll see.
The Internship. Got it on the list.
So the next one is Man of Steel. That's June 14th. This is the second Superman reboot. I guess we're supposed to just completely forget about the first reboot of a couple years ago.
The one that you and I saw in 3D here in Manhattan, right?
I think so.
There's like a 20-second 3D glasses spot. It was like one of the first 3D movies.
Right. Yeah, I don't know why they did it that way. But so this is interesting because it's the director really is what everyone's banking on here. It's Zack Snyder, the guy behind 300 and a lot of those movies that are all just produced and filmed in a sound studio of some kind with the background totally different than real life. But he seems to do a pretty good job at that. Because the original reboot that you and I saw was Bryan Singer, who was the director of the first two X-Men movies. And for some reason, he just didn't do well with this Superman. You and I thought it was kind of lukewarm. It didn't do well. It had Kevin Spacey in it as a villain. It seemed like it was going to be good, but then it just wasn't. Anyway, there's a lot of buzz for Man of Steel as this is for real this time. This is the Superman movie not to miss.
Awesome.
So I feel like we can't miss it.
We won't.
Okay. Next on the list is World War Z. Honestly, I'm just seeing this because it looks like an awesome zombie movie and it has Brad Pitt. I'm all generally right. a Brad Pitt fan. I think he does... I think he's... how do I want to phrase this? I think he's the actor that everyone loves to assume is overrated, but is actually maybe not underrated, but just exactly what you should expect from an actor. Good, solid performance.
I like Brad Pitt.
Yeah, yeah. So World War Z is a apocalypse sort of movie. He's got a family. He's running from zombies. They haven't really disclosed too much about the story yet, but it looks really well done. And yeah, I'm just excited for that. Then the next movie, and this one I'm probably more excited about than all three of the others combined.
Wow. I can't wait.
This next one is Elysium. This comes out August 9th. This has Matt Damon and Jodie Foster, and the important thing here is the director who did District 9, which I loved. I thought it was a fantastic sci-fi thriller, and it's also produced by Peter Jackson, who gets involved a little bit.
District 9, was that the South African one?
Yes.
Okay.
That starts as kind of a documentary and then morphs into like a crazy action thriller.
Right.
Stylistically and just... premise wise, I loved the way that movie was executed, and I'm looking forward to something similar with Elysium, which is a futuristic what do we do when the world moves beyond the problems we have today, but we have bigger problems with it's a sci-fi morality tale of sorts. Anyway, mostly because it's going to be badass action and it's got great actors and a great director.
Right. So. On. Wait, remind me who's starring in it? Did you tell me nice based?
Matt Damon and Jodie Foster.
Oh, okay. All right.
And then I guess I want to touch briefly on a couple movies coming out this week that I'm likely to see that maybe aren't must-sees, but I'm going to see them.
They're coming out this week?
Yeah, as in like today. They're
well,
opening.
Can we save that for the weekend picks in just a minute?
Yeah, sure.
Awesome. So we got four on the list with obviously... reserving the right to put more on.
Yeah. Those are the four I know for sure I'm going to see, and I think people will want to see if you want to be in tune with major pop culture of the summer. But otherwise, that fifth one is floating. We'll find it.
All right. Can't wait. So, must-see TV. We're in a time of transition here, Bob. Most of the network shows have ended for the season. Of course, we've got two outstanding must-sees right now in Mad Men and Game of Thrones. And it seems almost silly to preview those two, but just in case, here we go. number one on the list, Mad Men on AMC, created by Matt Weiner, who obviously cut his teeth writing on some of the later seasons of The Sopranos, stars John Hamm as Don Draper, 1960s advertising creative director with a secret and complicated past. What, is it any good? Yes. terrific writing, acting, art direction. Critics love it pretty much universally. Pulls in medium ratings for cable drama, to be quite honest. But those who watch it love it. It's usually in the running for Emmys, though Don Draper has, shockingly, never won Best Actor, John Hamm. It's also the best show on TV right now. So watch it if you're not watching it. Two, Game of Thrones on HBO. Also a must watch. This one's created by David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, adapted from the popular fantasy series A Song of Ice and Fire by George R.R. Martin. Huge cast. This season has Peter Dinklage as getting the lead billing. The premise... how about the king dies and pretty much everyone takes a shot at claiming the throne? Dragons.
Love it.
Armies, politics, naked bodies. And there you have it. Do you watch Game of Thrones? We know you watch Mad Men. We just talked about that, Bob. But you're watching Game of Thrones, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'm into it. I'm committed now, 3 seasons in. And there's something about the production value that makes it so compelling. Because the more you talk about it, when I talk about it with friends, the more I realize how much benefit of the doubt I give it in so many other domains. Like,
oh, really?
Yeah, like it's really biting off more than it can chew. Like, too many storylines. There's like 7 or 8 storylines, and half of them are just pathetic and shouldn't matter. But the production value and the epicness of it sort of compensates to the point where when you don't think about it, it seems like it all makes sense and it's designed to be told this way. But in reality, it should be half as many stories as it is on screen.
Fair enough. One of the things about it, though, it's even more popular than Mad Men. It's trendy for like celebrities to reveal their secret Game of Thrones love, and they have to rush home on Sunday night to watch it and stuff like that. So it's got more of a following. Oh, and then there's of course the people who've read the books, who it's hard to talk to without them giving you that little smirk, like you'll see.
Okay.
But you should definitely be watching this show. Those are the two must-sees right now. Just imagine me reaching out and grabbing you, urging you to watch Mad Men and Game of Thrones. But I want to round out the top 5. These are more extra credit. If you want something more to watch, you've already seen those for the week. 3, I'm going to put Arrested Development here on Netflix. We already talked about that too, created by Mitch Hurwitz. Just to continue the preview, makes it easy. It's the story of a wealthy family who lost everything and the one son who had no choice but to keep them all together. This is Arrested Development. with Jason Bateman, Jessica Walter, Will Arnett, Michael Cera, David Cross, others. This is the 4th season, 7 years after the 3rd. Just released all at once on Netflix. I should say that the first 2 seasons are generally regarded as some of the best comedy of all time. Even though no one watched it and it got canceled. And now this is the 4th season. And as you've heard us talk about already, it's getting sort of mixed reviews. Good, not greats, things like that. But it's pretty important to be watching. I don't know how long it'll stay on the list, but a week or 2 more probably. And then this crazy model, it's hard to know how long it's a current TV show, but you should watch it.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me, we'll have to talk about how we adapt our formula, because my movie picks, they're not like all Oscar nods or indie dramas that are going to get a lot of awards or anything. That's like a different list, but I think we're here to like talk about movies and TV that's just like America or the world is experiencing that's absolutely relevant and interesting, because otherwise that doesn't necessarily mean it's all very good.
Yeah, we want you to be able to have the conversations with people at the water cooler, stuff like that.
That's right, yeah.
So 2 more quickly, Veep on HBO, I'll just throw on there. Like I said,
yes!
We're in this middle time where, you know, not that much TV, but there's some good things to watch. Veep on HBO, created by Armando Iannucci, who also did The Thick of It and In the Loop. Are you a fan of Armando Iannucci's other stuff, Bob?
I saw In the Loop.
Okay.
And yeah, I'm a hesitant fan. I like where he's going, but I always feel like he's just slightly off on the execution. But I actually think Veep, by contrast, especially with Arrested Development, is pretty funny. It's a pretty good show.
I agree. I actually like this more than his previous work.
Me too.
Of course, I have an anti-British TV bias, so that probably helps explain it a little bit. But it stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus as Vice President of the United States, Selina Meyer. You know, it's one of those fast-paced dialogue comedies based on political satire. Critics like it fine, has a pretty good audience for an HBO half-hour comedy. Louis-Dreyfus won the Emmy last year for Actress in a Comedy. So, yeah,
nice.
It's a good show.
Yeah, and it has one crossover actor who's also in Arrested Development. I don't remember his name.
I should be able to remember his name, but it's Buster in Arrested Development.
Buster in Arrested Development, and he plays a similar like kind of goofball in Veep in some
actually,
ways.
Actually, they're really similar, the way he just waits on his mom in Arrested Development and the way he waits on Selena in Veep.
I totally, fully stamp of approval, endorse Veep. That is solid TV for right now, I'd say. Yeah.
Right on. So here's where I got to the sort of place you are. It's not obvious what to put in. There are some candidates, but I decided to go with Family Tree on HBO.
Oh, I'm watching that too.
Created by Christopher Guest of This Is Spinal Tap, A Mighty Wind, and Best in Show fame, to name just a few. You should know Christopher Guest, and it's very much like a Christopher Guest show. Stars Chris O'Dowd. It's a dude living in England who gets a box of doodads that leads him on journeys to discover his ancestors. You know, it's classic improvisational mockumentary, which seems like it's been done a million times, but Christopher Guest gets a pass because he pretty much invented this format.
Right.
Critics seem to like it fairly well enough. It doesn't have great ratings yet. I like it fine. It's only in my top five because we're in this gap again. But if you like something funny to watch, give it a whirl.
Yeah, I'm gonna tell you now. It does have a little bit of the boring factor. The problem with mockumentaries is if they're not tightly edited and really crisply done, they can just be boring by comparison to other movies.
I can't argue with that. But that's on the list this week. We've got some more candidates coming on that'll probably bump it off. But you know, feel free to give it a whirl. It's not a bad show.
Yep.
Okay. Let's talk about some weekend picks, Bob.
Okay.
Maybe I'll go first on this one. So,
do it.
The Killing season 3 starts on this Sunday on AMC. It's created by Vina Sood, who previously worked on Cold Case and Push Nevada. Stars Mireille Enos from Big Love, who played the Marquardt twins set on the compound. If you remember,
yeah,
those Marquardt twins.
And she's going to be in World War Z with Brad Pitt.
Whoa! I feel special closeness to anyone who's been on Big Love, especially down on the compound. Fans of ours will know, of course. We've spent a lot of time talking about Big Love.
Big Love, yep.
Also has Michelle Forbes, Brent Sexton, among others. Have you watched any of The Killing, Bob?
No, I haven't seen. I just see the gruesome previews of just lots of death and, yeah, I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be honest. I haven't watched any of it yet either, but I think
you're going to start with season 3?
No, I'm going to catch up here pretty quick. But here's the thing. I remember people liked it for the most part in the first season, but then most people were super pissed about the season finale of the first season. And then they didn't really forgive it during the second season. Ratings sort of dropped and it got canceled. But then they just needed something to put in that time slot, so they revived it. And hopefully they've learned some lessons. So if you are a fan, here I'm announcing it to remind you to go watch it again. If not, well, I'm giving a lukewarm recommendation. But I'm going to be watching it because I want to be a part of that, watching the first season, loving it, and then being pissed off at the finale. I want that firsthand information and experience for me. So if I talked you into it?
Not so much. Yeah. I think I'm going to be a pass on that one.
But. Fair enough. All right. But it's the biggest TV news of the week. So there you go. I got another pick as a movie, but I want to see what you do first and see if I choose the same one or see what you think of mine. Okay.
Okay.
What do you have for us, Bob?
Okay, I've got two movies. I'm probably going to see Now You See Me first because it's easy to find. It's a major release in all theaters.
Okay.
So this stars a lot of famous people. It's got Isla Fisher in it, Mark Ruffalo, Michael Caine, Morgan Freeman, Jesse Eisenberg. It's kind of got this ensemble cast, and it's got one of these feel-good plots that's hard to not have the audience enjoy it. And what I mean by that is a little manipulative because it's about a bunch of illusionists who put on shows that then steal money from rich people who don't deserve it because they're the 1% and then give it back to the audience. So it's like, how could you not love that premise? So it's kind of got one of these could go either way sort of deals where it's kind of gimmicky and manipulative, but the all-star cast and quite honestly, the premise does intrigue me. These illusionists that can get away with a lot of stuff, and then they're being chased by an FBI dude and that sort of thing.
All right.
The director is Louis Leterrier. I don't know how to say his name. He's French. He did The Transporter. I love The Transporter. Okay. But he also did The Transporter 2. Not quite as good. honestly, most of his stuff is action movie stuff that isn't that good. But he did the movie Unleashed, which I think you liked as well.
Who's that?
Jet Li.
Jet Li. I did like that.
Yeah. Yeah. He's hit and miss, but right now the initial buzz on this movie in terms of the will it suck factor is it goes either way. It's pretty even on the Rotten Tomato meter. So I'm not expecting much, but I'm in for a good ride. And the cast and premise seem fun.
Awesome. Okay, I can't wait for the second one.
Okay, this one we might overlap because this is a little more of a... So this is kind of an indie drama, and I got to find a theater that's playing it in this area. It's called The East.
Oh, not mine.
Oh, no. Why were we so excited? Why? There's like so many movies that come out now.
Right.
Oh, we didn't pick the same one. Maybe that's good. The East is a political thriller that... Now I'm trying to remember all the reasons why I wanted to watch it. It's this writer-director combination that did this other movie that I saw recently called Another Earth, which is kind of indie science fiction, which didn't do it for me, but I really like where they were going, and I think that they're going to come into their own here with this movie, The East. So this is a morality tale. It's about somebody who... It's actually a really complicated premise. It's hard to... explain. I thought I had notes on it, but now I'm looking and I don't. Just go see The East.
Got it, The East.
I'm going to go see it. I'll talk about it in more detail with the review. It's kind of more of an indie drama. It's going to be hard to find, but it's a political thriller. It looks intriguing. I know that's not great, but we'll
awesome.
We'll
hey, let you well know if more. If it gets your recommendation, that's a pretty good right there. Yeah. A movie that's caught my eye. Don't know if I'll have time to see a movie this weekend, but I'm looking at Kings of Summer.
Oh,
what do you think?
I did. Yeah, that was on my longer list. Kind of interesting.
Right. So about three teenage friends who decide to spend the summer in a cabin in the woods, living off the land, if IMDb is to be believed. Mm-hmm. Jordan Vogt Roberts directs. Chris Gaeta wrote it. Both seem relatively new to those roles. And I'll be honest, I'm mostly intrigued by the two actors, Nick Offerman and Alison Brie, even though they aren't the stars. But yeah, I don't know. You're a movies guys. What's your expert opinion on this, Bob?
Well, I love Alison Brie, but I think the coming of age story has kind of been beat to death. It's like, I don't know how interesting it can be if it's like people coming into their own after going alone into the woods and living on the land. And that premise sort of puts me to sleep. So that is not good, but it is getting some good buzz, and Alison Brie's a step in the positive column. So,
all right, well,
let me know what you think if you see it, though. Yeah.
Okay, sounds good. All right. Well, it's TV, it's movies, it's practically culture. Those are our weekend picks. Go forth and watch.
<Doo-doo>.
And that is our first episode of Practically Culture, Bob.
Wow, it's done. We did it.
Find us at practicallyculture.com. Catch our new YouTube channel where you can see video clips of this episode. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Again, I'm at Logan Bobobs, at Bob Caswell. Leave us a comment. Send us a tweet. Let us know how you like the new changes. Get out there and watch some TV and movies, people. It's good for you. Thanks for rocking.
All right. Have a good one.